You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The Founding Fathers crafted a constitution that has stood the test of time, but it has required tweaking. One very important tweak happened this day in 1947. That's when President Harry Truman signed the Presidential Succession Act. He was hoping to fix something left not quite finished when the Constitution was ratified in the 1780s. Let's look at how the nation has wrestled with the thorny question of who's in charge here. Should something dire happen to the president or the vice president? With us now, University of Michigan medical historian and PBS contributor, Dr. Howard Markell. I guess we kind of need to backtrack from this date in 1947 with the signing of the Presidential Succession Act and go all the way back to when the Constitution was ratified. How did the framers of the Constitution allow for what should happen should a president and or vice president die?
Well, the very famous part is Article 2, Section 1, and even Clause 6, by the way.
Well.
And it basically says, in the event of the death of the president, the vice president succeeds him or her. And, of course, the great joke about the vice president is that he only has really two jobs. One is to preside over the Senate. And the other is to take over in the event that the president dies. But that's it. That's all they said. And they did not really account for what if both the president and the vice president die, and what happens then when you succeed, and how does that succession work?
And when you think of history, it has certainly shown us presidents get sick, they are assassinated, they resign, and that issue of presidential succession is critical. So things were kind of left hanging.
They were. And this came up even very early, as early as the first Congress in the early 1790s. People were talking about it. They were debating it. And one thought was to have the Secretary of State be the third in line. Now, that was Thomas Jefferson, who was an ardent anti-Federalist, and the Federalists were in charge of the Congress, so they were not having anything of that. They were not going to promote Thomas Jefferson to that job, which he ultimately got anyway. But that stalled it for a while. Then later on, it became something of an issue, which should it be Secretary of State, who is the senior member of the president's cabinet and the oldest department in the cabinet, or should it be an elected official, such as the president pro tem of the Senate, who tends to be the most senior senator and often the oldest.
And chosen by the people and versus chosen, appointed by the president.
Right, right.
So on this day in 1847, when Harry Truman signed that Presidential Succession Act, what did it do?
Well, it straightened out the line of succession and changed it a bit so that it was not the president pro tem of the Senate who was next in line, but it was the Speaker of the House.
Okay.
And then the president pro tem of the Senate, and then the Secretary of State, and down the line.
All right. And then in 1967 comes the 25th Amendment, which nowadays is getting tossed around on social media and elsewhere, it seems, each time President Trump sends out an inflammatory tweet.
Right.
You know, a lot of us, that isn't top of mind, the 25th Amendment. What's in it, and particularly Section 4, it's never been acted on?
Well, Section 4 is that you could actually have other people decide that the president is disabled for reasons of health.
Now, and I'm taking no sides, but this is the kind of conversation
right.
we're seeing on Twitter a lot.
Right. But what it doesn't say is who are the people who get to decide that and what are the criteria for deciding such a coup.
Yes.
In
yes,
a way,
indeed.
It would be a coup d'etat.
Yes.
And it's been described by ethicists and bioethicists and presidential historians and health experts as way too vague for late 20th and certainly 21st century medical constructs, because there are a great many physical and mental health disabilities that could prevent somebody from doing his or her job as president of the United States. But how do you diagnose them? And what are the criteria? And who gets to diagnose them? And is there a trial? Is that the appropriate way of even doing it? So there's all sorts of vagaries there. And the president has been given the option to say, I am disabled. Well, I'm having an operation, for example. Ronald Reagan did not do this when he had his colon removed, but George Bush did when he had thyroid surgery. So I'm going to be under the knife. I am going to be anesthetized. I will give up my presidency to the vice president from 12 midnight on Monday till 12 midnight on Thursday or something like that, or longer. Or let's say the president had a stroke. But here's the problem. Let's say the president does have a disabling stroke and he is no longer to write or read or comprehend.
You and I talked about Woodrow Wilson, right. So incapacitated by a stroke. The First Lady was secretly acting as president. People didn't know.
Right. So it's a real problem. And it's not the last time that a president or even a politician has been less than forthcoming about his or her health. And we've seen this again and again and again. John Kennedy with his Addison's disease, not to mention the steroids he was taking and the painkillers he was taking and the deals he was making while under the influence. Eisenhower had a serious heart attack. He had a mild heart attack, then a serious one. He had an intestinal obstruction, and he probably had a mild stroke during his presidency, and no one knew or reported on it in real time.
And then Ronald Reagan, of course, we know the assassination attempt. But then we know he ultimately
had Alzheimer's disease, and we don't know quite when did that start. And it sounds like, and some presidential historians have suggested, that that process started while he was still in office.
So there are voices, aren't there, calling for the president to have an annual exam, physical and mental?
Yes, yes, and reported in real time to the American public. And this is debated back and forth. Just as a voter, not to mention as a historian and a physician, I think the American people are entitled to that. Now, you and I are entitled to privacy with our health issues, and I think that's a very good thing. But we're not really public personalities. I mean, you are, of course. But,
but one thing is
– But you're not a public official.
If you step into the office of the President of the United States, there's –
The most powerful position in the world. That's a different story. And that has been – wrestled and tossed with, mostly by the politicians who make the laws. But I think it's time that we make that 25th Amendment a lot clearer and decide, is there a presidential health review board? Who are these doctors and how are they assigned? And who are they accountable to? Are they working for the president? Or are they working for the American people? Who are they appointed? How independent they are? Very similar to judges in a way.
They're good questions. It's hard to see it not getting politicized in 2017 America.
Oh, no, not 21st century America.
University of Michigan medical historian and PBS contributor, Dr. Howard Markel. Thanks so much.
Thanks so much.